Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamin.
From the frozen North Slope to soggy Southeast, from the Kuskokwim Delta to the upper Yukon River, from the far reaches of the Aleutian Chain to the heart of the interior, this is AK. I'm Ellen Lockyer. This week on AK, Best in Show.
Sometimes the flight may start in Seattle and end in Seattle.
We're celebrating the laid-back holiday weekend with a cornucopia of stories. We'll hear why some kids have two moms, listen to a Samoan choir, and meet Betty McDonald.
I just go on and on, and you have to stop me.
That's all coming up on AK from the Alaska Public Radio Network. Welcome to AK. I'm Ellen Lockyer. It's been quite a year for Alaska. Governor Sarah Palin garnered national media attention during her sprint for the vice presidency. Or was it the presidency?
Forever, I'm going to be Sarah from Alaska.
40-year Alaska Senator Ted Stevens went down at the polls and could be down for the count if an appeals court doesn't see it his way next year. And Exxon finally forked over some cash to Prince William Sound fishermen. Not very much, unfortunately.
People want closure. People want an end to this.
AK took note of all these events. Former AK host Rebecca Shear interviewed Sarah Palin, the governor, before she became Sarah Palin, the media darling.
I cannot tell you how good it is to be here. It's been just a blast traveling across the country and bringing good word from Alaska all across the country.
We noted Ted Stevens' day in court and his return to Anchorage days before the election.
Catherine, I really thank you for coming out today, and I'm overwhelmed by this crowd.
And we traced the progress of the commercial fishermen versus Exxon until its disappointing conclusion at the hands of the United States Supreme Court in June. So now let's hear some fun stuff. This week we're cooking up a recipe for some of the best stories of the year with a spicy mix of personalities, music, and just a touch of family relations to sweeten the pot. Speaking of joy, even a person with two left feet gets the urge to dance when those Latin rhythms start pulsating. Let's start off by saying goodbye to a couple of friends who set the stage, state capital, jumping. For some years, salsa dancers Antonio Diaz and Heather Hoagland have taught Latino dancing in Juneau, getting folks in the state's capital up and on their feet. The two instructors decided to take a break with a trip to Peru earlier this year, but they promise to return. In a story that aired in January, K2's John Ryan tells us the infectious Latin beat they are leaving behind shows no sign of slowing down.
One, two, three. I go really right behind her.
And this is very a difficult position because the guy's hand naturally wants to go here. And you just have to be careful.
That's Antonio Diaz and Heather Hoagland teaching some advanced moves at their final salsa class in downtown Juneau. The husband-wife team are leaving Juneau to be near Diaz's family in his native Lima, Peru. They plan to be gone about a year. Doug Sandvik of Juneau says he's been taking dance lessons with Hoagland and Diaz ever since they started teaching here 5 years ago.
They made an incredible difference in the dance community in Juneau. They're so interested in spreading their love of the music and how to move to it. It's been just a remarkable time being a part of their group.
There's a core group of a dozen or two salsa junkies who show up faithfully for the Saturday night salsa dances week in and week out. But Heather Hoagland has hundreds of people on her Salsa Juneau mailing list. Diaz says summertime visitors to Juneau are surprised to find a hotbed of salsa in the shadow of a glacier.
You know, out of all places, Juneau, Alaska, wow. Such a south of the border kind of dance. Very tropical, but still here it's happening.
Diaz's family runs a folkloric dance studio in the Peruvian capital. He was living in Seattle when Hoagland recruited him to teach Latin dance at the Alaska Folk Festival. The couple has taught and organized Latin dances including salsa, merengue, cha-cha, the rueda from Cuba, and bachata from the Dominican Republic. At one recent salsa gathering, there were six different nationalities in a group of a dozen people. Doug Sandvik says the diversity grew from the instructor's welcoming attitude.
They have been so inclusive in bringing everybody together, from the Latin community to the, shall I say, gringo community. It's been just a really good ride with them in town.
The couple weren't the first to teach Latin dance or play Latin music in Juneau. Shortly after arriving, Diaz joined up with Juneau's long-standing Latin band, Salsa Borealis. But by all accounts, Hoagland and Diaz have taken salsa to new levels of popularity and authenticity in the capital city. The Latino-Gringa couple have even helped some Juneau Latinos connect with their own heritage. Jeanette Perlasca grew up in Veracruz, Mexico, but she says as a youngster, she always listened to American music.
We didn't like salsa music because we consider it low-class people music. So when I came here, I realized I really liked the beat and I wanted to learn with Heather and Antonio. Since the very beginning, I felt really welcome and I felt great that an American, Heather, was dancing so well. So it's now part of me. I really feel like I belong to my country and my community where I came from. Something that I gained here is weird, but that's how it happened with me.
Doug Sandvik says everyone on the salsa scene is worried how well it will endure the prolonged absence of its prime movers once they head to Peru. Antonio Diaz says he's not worried. His friend Alejandro Soria of Juneau, by way of Uruguay, will take over singing with Salsa Borealis and DJing the Saturday salsa nights.
The nexus that has been built is very tight right now, and that's what hurts the most because we're leaving it. But we're not worried because they're going to continue. The salsa family right now is really tight.
He even predicts that salsa will grow in his and Heather's absence. He thinks Juneau's new ban on smoking in bars will encourage more people to grab partners and spin, slide, and dip to Latin rhythms. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
Speaking of travel, this year's high energy prices pushed airline tickets into the stratosphere. And now that the holidays are here, grumpy passengers are queuing up in long lines for the inevitable wait for the gate. But folks, Crab Bait Radio is here to tell you to count your blessings. Nothing beats winter air travel to and from Alaska. And as Joe Vicnicki and Matt Lichtenstein tell us, tongue firmly in cheek, that just getting back on the ground is worthy of celebration.
In an effort to fill more seats, Alaska Airlines announced this week it plans a new approach for marketing daily flights into Southeast Alaska during the wintertime. It's a move designed to tap into the thrill seeker who's coming to Alaska to live life on the edge. The airline says it'll market the new flights under a new brand, Wild Alaska Airlines. The flights are aimed at the passengers who are looking for that white-knuckle roller coaster ride that comes with landing in Juneau in January. The airline took a few reporters along on a test flight last winter. Crab Bait Radio's Joe Vicnicki has this report.
Figured out we weren't able to make it down that time, and also a piece of the wing seems to be missing, but we're going to go ahead and swing around here and take her back up to 10,000 feet, and then we'll drop back down and give another try. That ought to freak them out. Yeah, that ought to quiet them down a little bit back there. I know that mountain's around here somewhere. Hey, Bob, your mic's still on.
No doubt about it. Alaska Plate 64 and 65 through Southeast Alaska. They're not for the first time traveler, or maybe not for the 100th time traveler for that matter. Alaska Airlines spokesperson Windy and Overcast says the new flights are pretty much open-ended.
You may land in Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, and Juneau. Or you may make a quick detour to Yakutat or Vladivostok. Well, depending on the daring of the pilot and the fortitude of the flight crew. Sometimes the flight may start in Seattle and end in Seattle. Or you could wind up somewhere else for the night and get a rebound ticket for round two the next day.
The airline will sell T-shirts that say, I survived flight 64 and turbulence. I'll show you turbulence. For Crab Bait Radio, 10,000 feet, I'm Joe Vicnicki.
Okay, folks, go ahead and buckle up. We're going to take another pass at the runway here.
Hey, 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 land this thing. Please land it.
I've always loved you.
I got something to tell you, too. I slept with your wife.
That's Crabbait Radio's Matt Lichtenstein and Joe Vicnicki. And now it's time to take our trip around the state with AK's regular 300 Villages segment. This week, we talk to Cooper Landing on the Kenai Peninsula.
My name is Mona Painter. I live in Cooper Landing, Alaska. And at the present, I'm president of the Cooper Landing Community Club. We're located on the Kenai Peninsula, 100 miles south of Anchorage, on the shores of Kenai Lake and Kenai River. And, of course, the famous red salmon fishing area, Russian River, is right here in Cooper Landing at the west end of town. There are probably about 370 year-round folks here now. Population doubles, triples in the summer, of course. Historically, there were Dena'ina Indians here, and Eskimo people lived here prehistorically. And historically, the gold miners came, and some of the early fellows stayed and actually became Cooper Landing, or known as Cooper Landing, in the 1920s. It's a diverse community, and we have several nonprofit groups. One that gets in the news fairly often are the Sexy Senior Dumpster Cleaners, who are a group of seniors who every Monday clean dumpster sites, Cooper Landing, Moose Pass, and Hope, which are, it would be a 100-mile round trip to do all those in one day. And the money they make, they donate to the community.
We spoke with Mona Painter in Cooper Landing. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to get every community in Alaska on the radio. Coming up after the break.
He told me that once he received a letter that was addressed to Sea Otter Jones, Alaska, and it got to him.
The one and only Sea Otter Jones. That's ahead. Welcome back to AK. I'm Ellen Lockyer. About a year ago, former AK host Rebecca Shear spoke with a remarkable woman who had devoted the better part of 48 years to making Anchorage a better place. Betty McDonald is all the more notable because she was one of the first African Americans to hold down a teacher's job with the city school district. Shear caught McDonald shortly before the teacher was to move south for retirement, and Shear asked McDonald what life was like in the last frontier, nearly half a century ago.
Free. I knew it was the place I wanted to rear my children because they could develop and be themselves. They received fantastic education here in this city. You have no idea the quality. You can't beat it any place. I mean, this, I don't know what it's like now. I don't read anything in the newspaper where a youngster has a 4.0 average or the kids that are really doing things. Every time I pick up the paper, I see where a youngster has done something wrong. And I'd like to see more positive articles on the kids in our city. I was in that classroom. I know all kids are not perfect, but I do know if you respect them, they too will respect you in turn. I'll go to my grave with that feeling. I had fun. Did I want to retire? No. Did I have to retire? Yes.
Do you remember your first day walking into the classroom in 1960?
Scared to death. Okay. Absolutely petrified. Said my little prayer, as I always did every morning before class started. Yeah, I'm scared to death. What will they think of me? How will I relate? Remember, this is 1960. Okay. I am going into Windler Junior High School. Most of the students were from College Village. Okay. And me. Yeah, it was interesting.
How did they respond to you when you first met?
a little standoffish, but I worked around it. I am blessed with a personality that is non-threatening, unless, you know, you are willfully disobedient, and that becomes another story. But very supportive parents welcomed me at back to school night. That's when I was petrified. Oh my God. They welcomed me into Anchorage.
So I'm curious to hear about the Anchorage community when you moved up here. I'm assuming the African American population was not overwhelming at the time.
Very, very few. Lots of military people. Blanche McSmith was here, and she went on to go to the legislature. It was small. And I never had an opportunity to really get into the community as I desired to do. I was always busy with the community course or some organization or working. You know, I had a tendency to enjoy what I did, and sometimes I overdid it. I worked constantly.
Sounds like it paid off, though.
Yeah. That's why I am hesitant about us leaving. The people here have always been so warm. And that, I've been very happy here. But as we have grown older, I don't know what I'll do. Because I can't participate in anything. I have my memories here.
So if you do leave, and you've said that perhaps it might be time to move on soon, this might be a hard question, but what do you think you're going to miss the most?
Oh, Rebecca. I still have students who know where I live and who still will come by when they're home. I had to have my tree trimmed the other day, and the young man came in, and he said, ma'am, did you ever teach at Bartlett? And I said, oh, no. What year? Because whenever I get that, you know. And he said, I was in your 9th grade adolescent and modern problems class. And he said, Mrs. McDonald. And I said, yeah? How could you recognize me? He says, thank you. So much. Thank you. You saved my life. I said, what did I do? He said, you ask our class one day, and now exactly how do you plan to eat when you get grown if you cannot read, write, or reason? And I had forgotten about that. And he said, I thought about that a long time. And he said, do you mind if I give you a hug? I hear from kids, and I see them constantly on TV, or I read about them, and now that I've learned how to master this email, the address is passed around, and it makes me feel good. If I move, I don't know, I think I'd lose them, and that lets me hold on to my... I've had a really rough year, so I don't think we have a choice but to move. It's my husband's health. It's time now to go to that second phase of our lives. Where will I go? I don't know. Our son wants us to come to Hermosa Beach, but all the beautiful people live there, bikinis and etc. This is home since 1960. It's a long time. It's a long time. That's Betty McDonald.
Alaska's history is full of unique characters. One of them is Sea Otter Jones, a United States Fish and Wildlife biologist who was the first resident manager of the old Aleutian Islands Wildlife Refuge. Now that's part of the Alaska Maritime Wildlife Refuge. Robert D. Jones passed away a decade ago, leaving some big shoes to fill. But in this story, he lives again in the memories of two of the people who knew him best.
He was among the first troops to go ashore at ADAC when the Army Air Corps occupied ADAC. And Bob was a radar officer.
Vern Bird remembers Jones from their fieldwork days in the 1960s. Jones had been stationed in the Aleutians during the infamous Forgotten War to scout out emergency airfield locations. But unlike most of his fellows, Jones embraced the island's wild weather and challenging seas.
He clearly loved being in the Aleutians, and he used every opportunity to climb the nearest mountain, get out and, you know, really look over the countryside.
After the war, Jones couldn't wait to get back to the chain. A trained biologist, Jones jumped at an opportunity presented by the United States Fish and Wildlife Service when the agency decided to take a hands-on approach to the previously unmanned string of refuges.
So Bob moved to Cole Bay and set up shop to manage the Aleutian Islands refuge.
But getting around the Aleutians was never easy. Jones copied Aleut fishermen and used a Cape Cod fishing dory to do the job.
You could still fly to Amchitkan Adak in those days because the military maintained bases. So Bob would fly to those places, and then he would use the dory out of there, you know, to operate on the islands nearby.
During the early 1950s, he immersed himself in a program on Amchitka Island to return the ailing sea otter population there to health, thus his nickname. All the while, his reputation grew.
He told me that once he received a letter from somewhere in the American Midwest that was addressed to Sea Otter Jones, Alaska, and it got to him.
Chuck Jones was 6 years old when his mother, Dorothy, married Sea Otter.
She and I moved from Los Angeles to Cold Bay. I loved it. It couldn't have been a greater place for a kid. And getting Bob Jones as my stepfather was the luckiest thing that ever happened to me.
Life with Sea Otter never lacked adventure or education.
Walking on the tundra, he would point out signs to me of this animal and that animal. And his knowledge was just encyclopedic.
About this time, Sea Otter began another campaign. Foxes, introduced to the Aleutians by Russian fur traders, were busy decimating the local avian populations, especially that of the ground-nesting Aleutian Canada goose, Vern Bird.
So he started removing foxes from Amchitka with the idea of restoring native Aleutian wildlife.
And Sea Otter wanted to find evidence that the rumored-to-be-extinct Aleutian Canada goose was still out there somewhere.
Well, the Aleut said he was the best small boatsman in the Aleutian Islands, and they all respected him as the best.
And it took all his skill to get to Boldier Island, an uninhabited piece of rock that was so off the charts, no human had been known to get there.
He speculated, since foxes had never been introduced to Boldier, that that's likely to be where they would have persisted. And sure enough, he found them nesting there.
Sea Otter wrote in his log on the 25th of June, 1962. Progressed to Boldier and landed. A trip was then made by dory around the island. 56 Canada geese observed. Eventually, goslings were taken and raised in a successful fish and wildlife captive propagation program. The foxes were driven out and the geese began to thrive, but clouds were beginning to form over the Aleutians again, this time in the form of Federal Atomic Energy Commission nuclear bomb experiments.
He called them the bomb people. He viewed them as evil.
The bomb people changed everything.
I asked him once what his favorite island was. He did tell me Amchitka, and that's where they exploded two or three atomic bombs underground, and he hated them.
Sea Otter couldn't stand to see his favorite island devastated. After years of turning down promotions, Sea Otter took a post in Anchorage. He studied the brants of the Yukon Delta, worked on a PhD, and settled down in Eagle River. But then...
They told him that he had to have an immediate operation. He would never speak again, and he could never eat. He would have to be fed through these tubes. He thought for a few seconds, and then he told the doctor, "That's not for me."
He died of cancer in 1998, 3 years before his Aleutian Canada goose, now renamed the Aleutian Cackling Goose, was taken off the endangered species list.
And I miss him. You can probably tell. He was a great man, and I was just lucky that my mom married him. I'm really glad somebody's remembering him.
The Aleutian Islands Wildlife Refuge is now a unit of the Alaska Maritime Wildlife Refuge, and a fishing dory, much like the one Sea Otter used, hangs in refuge headquarters in Homer. quiet testimony to the man whose persistence in the face of challenges has become his legacy. Sea Otter Jones and Betty McDonald both lived during the World War II era, and the big band sound of that time never really fades away. These days, some Matanuska Valley teens are carrying on the legacy of Duke Ellington and Glenn Miller. Just Playin' Jazz has a bevy of horn players, a scat singer, and is wowing audiences from Palmer to Fairbanks. In this story that first aired in May of this year, I sit down with some of the young musicians to find out why they are so hip about the music of their granddaddies. That's one healthy horn section, and the players behind the instruments are all in middle or high school. Band director Hank Hartman says Just Playin' Jazz is open to any teen from any of the Valley's schools.
So we just kind of made a community effort that if somebody wanted to do this, they didn't have to be good, but if they wanted to do it, they were welcome to come on in.
The idea for a community band kicked around in Hartman's head for quite a few years. He came up to Alaska with the military during the 1970s. He played his trumpet in the U.S. Air Force band. Later, he opened a music store in laid-back Wasilla. Matanuska Music is now the official headquarters of Just Playin' Jazz, a smoking hot combo that's just back from April's University of Alaska Fairbanks Jazz Fest. And it's where I sat down with a few of the brass section musicians.
I was thinking that double C
might be try the double C.
You got to limber up.
That's the lowest C. That's as high as I can go.
That's Dylan Bryant. The ninth grade trumpeter says he doesn't spend much time warming up. Bryant's been with the band since middle school. But Ben Evans made it into the band in the fifth grade. They bent the rules a little bit for him. Evans' horn is a slide trombone.
That was really the first instrument I ever really played. Fifth grade is when I started, and I just thought it had a cool sound and kind of liked the slide. Just kind of a unique instrument.
The lure of jazz has come early to these two, which sometimes clashes with the music of the hip-hop generation. Guitar player Alicia Kerr, a Houston high schooler, isn't too impressed with contemporary music.
Junk, and they're all repetitive, so when you go to learn it, like the chorus is catchy, but everything behind it isn't.
She's a Brian Setzer fan, and she says JPJ has opened up her musical horizons. She plays both electric and acoustic guitar.
I haven't been sight reading for that long, so it's kind of hard to catch on to all at once, but I'm getting better.
Hartman says students must read music to be in the band, although no particular level of proficiency is required. Eight of JPJ's members were picked for UAF's Jazz Fest Honor Band in April. That is, instructors chose them for their expertise. UAF Music Department's Linda Harriger helps coordinate the Jazz Fest.
Each year they come up and just wow us with their performances. These JPJ kids continue on and they bring a wonderful excitement to this program too.
A good many JPJ members go on to musical pursuits in college. That's Randy Bernier, trumpeter and scat singer performing at UAF last month.
The moment I put the trumpet to my lips, it was like instant. I was like, I don't want to do anything else with the rest of my life. This is just perfect.
Bernier's been accepted into Boston's prestigious Berklee School. Other bandmates, like high school senior Doug Lentz, also plan a musical future.
That's it?
Yes.
Lentz and band member Derek Yeomans warm up their saxophones.
The old swing, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, Glenn Miller. I love it. In fact, I'm going to go to college and I'm going to major in it and hopefully get my own band started and come back up here and help Hank out with JPJ if he'll let me.
If there is one thing that characterizes all of the JPJ crew, it is their enthusiasm for a style of music that refuses to become dated. Yeomans, a big Clarence Clemens fan, says the UAF gig brings kids together.
All the bands kind of like merge and everyone gets to meet each other and, you know, share tips and secrets. And it's just really cool because everyone's, you know, they're not separated by schools like sports teams usually are.
Jazz Fest inspired Dylan Bryant.
There was a trumpet player, Bobby Shue. Man, I was amazed. He said a double C, not hard. And my jaw dropped to the floor and I had to pick it up. There was double C. I've been trying to hit that for about 2 years now.
Most of the jazz band members play in their own school bands as well. I asked, do they ever get flack from their high school buddies?
Generally, the reaction is, oh, you're in band. But not everyone's that way. There are a lot of people that are fine with it.
They admit to being called band nerds from time to time, but they all agree being in the band outweighs any peer pettiness and is worth the hours of practice. Coming up after the break, grandmother raises the kids.
Even though your family, even though your grandma, there are times. But if you start looking for the rewards, you're going to find them.
Stay tuned. Welcome back to AK. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Was it Mae West who said, too much of a good thing is wonderful? Well, having one loving mother is good, but having two loving moms is even better. In a story that aired first in May of this year, AK's Scott Burton spoke with partners Martha Murray and Jennifer Shapland about raising two boys in a family that, by its very nature, pushes love beyond national and traditional boundaries.
As their two children play with the neighbor kids outside, Mom and Mom are preparing for dinner in their kitchen. The two met at a potluck Thanksgiving dinner, and Martha says Jennifer impressed her so much, she asked her out that same night.
I'm not usually the kind of person who asks somebody out for a date when they first met them, but I guess I just thought she was really fun. I still think that.
So I fooled her pretty good, huh?
Several years of partnership later, Jennifer gave birth to Denali by alternative insemination. He's now 14. They later adopted Rogelio from Guatemala, who is now 9 years old. For the trip to the predominantly Catholic country, Jennifer says Martha had to pretend she was a family member rather than Jennifer's partner. They explained this to Denali.
We told him that in Guatemala, they don't consider that two moms and a boy make a family. And he totally understood that. He really grasped it at age 7 and said, well, I'll fix that. He said, when I grow up, I'm going to go down to Guatemala and tell them that two moms and two boys do make a family.
The boys come in and the four sit down to dinner.
We are thankful for this food and each other to share with. Amen. Bless be.
The moms both work full-time plus and are heavily involved with the community. They say that in their relationship, their roles at home have been determined by their strengths. Jennifer, who works in his accountant and runs a child's arts agency, tends to be the authoritarian.
Although the kids decided I should have Father's Day because I'm more like a dad than a mom.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're so strict.
Mm-hmm. Somebody has to be. You told me yourself if it was just you and Martha, you'd walk all over.
It would be complete and total chaos.
Hey, I'm not that much of a pushover.
You let me play on the computer for like 50 minutes.
Martha manages a medical lab at a large clinic and is an active volunteer, including spending time at both the boys' schools. She does most of the cooking at home and might be considered the homemaker of the two. But despite their combined efforts, Martha remembers being told that they cannot be a family.
When Denali was about 2 years old was when they were doing that defensive marriage business. And so I went down and testified. And Lauren Lehman, I looked him straight in the eye and I said, I have walked the living room with this child. I have changed his diapers. I have fed him. I have comforted him. How can you tell me we're not a family?
And Martha's not the only one among them who's had their family life questioned. Third grader Rogelio is being teased by a schoolmate about having two moms. There's another child of same-sex parents at school, but the other girl doesn't seem to get made fun of.
I sometimes get sad that she doesn't get teased, but I am happy that she doesn't get teased because I know how it feels.
Denali just won't accept discrimination.
If I want to be friends with somebody, that's usually one of the first few things that I tell them, is that, like, my moms are lesbians, and most people take it fine.
After a negative experience at one summer camp, Denali learned he can't go to the religious camps that don't accept his family structure, and that's a bummer, because he loves camp. And sometimes he wishes he had a dad for what he thinks of as guy things to do, like getting out and building rope swings or learning about carpentry. Nick Parmentier is one of Denali's teachers in middle school. Although he admits he can't hear what happens out in the halls, he doesn't see any negatives in Denali's family life, but he does see a positive.
Whether it's two moms, whether it's an aunt or uncle, whether it's a step-parent, whether it's an adopted parent, whether it's anyone, the advantage is that he's got a very strong, very close bond with his family.
And these guys are a family, and one they're proud of. Martha is especially pleased with Denali's attitude.
It's fun to see him be excited about it and easy about it and totally proud of us and totally supporting us. And
I think that would delight any parent to have a child speak into the microphone and be proud of his family.
Yes.
This Mother's Day weekend, Denali, Jennifer, Martha, and Rogelio will join several other families with adopted children at a retreat camp. The families have been gathering for almost 15 years. The adults exchange parenting tips, socialize, and the kids play. Among them will be kids adopted from all over the world and with equally diverse family structures. Moms and moms, dads and moms, step-parents, single parents, aunts, uncles, grandparents, demonstrating all the different ways to be a family. For AK, I'm Scott Burton.
The family with two moms is unusual, but family structure is changing fast. Across the country, millions of people are raising their children's children. Grandmother Patsy Parker is one of them. And as Rebecca Shear relates in this story that aired early this year, Parker adopted her own grandchildren when family circumstances led her down that path.
Uncle, you are an acrobat. You should be in the circus.
We're inside the rather hopped-up home of Patsy Parker, a South Anchorage resident who's just adopted two kids, Thomas.
Thomas.
And John.
John.
Thomas is four.
Four.
You're four?
Yeah, and my Baba 10.
I'm 10.
And John is, well, he's 10. As for Patsy,
I'll be 65 in May.
No, you're not 65.
You're 64. I'll be 65 in May. I'm 64. Okay.
Which might seem surprising if Patsy were a brand new mom, but she's actually done all this before.
I've been taking care of people some time. My children were born, so it was my kids, my grandparents, my mother, my dad, my husband, you know, now the grandkids.
Yep, the grandkids. Patsy Parker is one of 5,500 grandparents in Alaska and one of 1.5 million grandparents in the U.S. who are raising their grandchildren. Only Patsy took it one step further.
Let's have Ms. Parker stand in. You sworn?
Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the testimony you shall give in the case not pending before this court be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
She adopted them.
Do you already have a relationship with Thomas and John?
Yes, I do.
And that is what?
As grandmother.
Okay. Is it your desire today to formalize the relationship you have with them by becoming their legal parent?
Yes.
Thank you. No, I have no further questions.
Patsy moved to Alaska in 1957 and had her first child in 1963. 4 decades later, she never expected to be raising kids all over again, especially on her own. Her husband died in 1993. But Thomas and John's home life was too dysfunctional for her and them to bear, full of domestic violence, emotional abuse, and substance addictions. So in April 2006, when Thomas was rushed to the hospital after ingesting crack cocaine, Patsy knew something had to change. By August the following year, parental rights were terminated, And on December 6th, 2007, at the Anchorage Courthouse.
So I am pleased to recommend approval. We will see if we can get it signed as quickly as possible. And at that point, it will become effective. And with that, we'll stand in recess.
Thank you, Your Honor.
When you get ready to retire and you're looking forward to not, you know, either working or not working or traveling or doing whatever, and all of a sudden you're straddled with two kids that you're going to have for at least 15 years, it's like, yeah, it's tough.
But I could see that that was the only way these kids are going to be able to live and have a life is if I didn't.
And it's true. Since moving in with Patsy, Thomas and John are like whole new boys. John used to hate going to bed so much he'd punch holes in the walls. And until about a year ago, Thomas never spoke. If anything, he'd just throw tantrums.
So he never spoke when he was little.
No,
because you can't stop him now.
No, you can't. You cannot. Sometimes that can be just as wearing as the screaming.
Wearing, indeed.
Shut up.
See, financially, raising your grandkids can be rough. Patsy's still working, and now she has to think about buying enough clothing and food for three. But the biggest challenges she has...
Physical. I'm not young anymore. You know, I don't have the stamina I did. So the corners don't always get clean and the dust isn't always wet, honey.
Me and my back, we did my lifesaver.
Where is your lifesaver?
In the door. I need to take.
Everybody else at the PTA might be young 30s. They might be 60, 70, older, and just having to run around after a toddler, it's wearing.
Christina Lowther is the coordinator of Grand Families Network Project, a statewide program started by Volunteers of America in 1990. The project offers grandparents raising grandchildren support groups, a resource guide for health care, financial aid, legal services, etc., plus a toll-free hotline and...
I haven't read this one, but I think...
A lending library.
Oh. Well, this is not the one I was looking for, but this one is called My Grandma is My New Mommy.
Can you read a little of it, just in the beginning?
One day, Angela and I were taken by a caseworker to go live with our grandma. Grandma said, "Your mommy and daddy are sick, and they can't take care of you. I love you both so much," she continued, "and I want you to live with me until your parents get better." I was sad. It would be nice to think that the grandparents are stepping up to the plate because something tragic has happened and they've lost a son or daughter and they are now raising the child. It's more likely that their son or daughter has run into some sort of trouble where they're just unable to be a stable parent.
But whatever reason grandparents have for stepping up to the plate, Christina says it's a growing phenomenon across the country and the state.
When a child has to be taken from their family's house, the best scenario, according to the state, is to put them with somebody they already know, to put them in a familiar setting. I do know that the majority of grandparents raising their grandchildren are living in rural Alaska, and actually only a third of the grandparents are 60 and older.
Mom, meet the app.
You want it grilled or you just want cheese?
So at 64, Patsy Parker is actually in a minority.
It takes a lot of patience, a lot of fortitude, and you're going to question if it's something you should do or not. You know, am I the right person to do this? Even though your family, even though your grandma, you know, am I? There are times. But if you start looking for the rewards, you're going to find them. Just like him in there talking and playing right now, you know.
Patsy's learning patience, fortitude, and how to play a mean game of Lego Star Wars 2 on the Xbox 360. And the boys, who used to punch walls and scream and cry all night long, they're finally learning love.
John, what is it we say when we go to bed? How do we... you remember it? Good night.
Good night.
Sleep tight.
Sleep tight. Don't let the bubble bite.
Sweet dreams.
Dreams. See you in the morning. Love you.
How long I've loved you. You know I love you still. Will I wait a lonely lifetime? If you want me to, I will. Love you forever.
In the Roman Catholic Church, music has long had a place in church liturgy. In fact, the American Catholic bishops have set guidelines for the choir's participation in the Mass, although there is no limit put on the choir's cultural expression. At Anchorage's Our Lady of Guadalupe and St. Benedict's Catholic Churches, parishioners lift their voices in worship and in songs that reflect cultures from the South Pacific to south of the border.
Hallelujah.
The Catholic bishops say music assists the assembled believers to express and share the gift of faith that is within them, and it doesn't matter if it's one voice or many. The Second Vatican Council stated, choirs must be diligently promoted in Catholic churches and in music and Catholic worship. That's the bishops talking again. It's written that music can also unveil a dimension of meaning and feeling integral to the human personality. It cannot be ignored. At 8:30 on a snowy Sunday morning, Our Lady of Guadalupe's English-speaking choir warms up the congregation with a traditional hymn in the three-quarter beat familiar to the Western ear. But the choir's role is not just pretty window dressing.
When you sing it, it's more than just when you say it.
Deacon Ted Green says there are specific places in the Mass where the choir sings parts of the liturgy.
It comes out of a call and response. Father is the presider or the leader, but the singing tends to involve the assembly. So the Second Vatican Council said there's something about us being brought together by song. And so when the call and response is a way to say, oh yeah, we need to pay attention here. We're singing together.
Eastertime Alleluias, the Lord's Prayer, even Amen, are sung prayers. Long ago, all those responses were sung in solemn Gregorian chant, but not anymore. The church in our times has introduced the vernacular into the liturgy, definitely spicing up an ancient tradition. Frank Cadavos plays the conga drums for the Filipino choir at Our Lady of Guadalupe.
We try to recruit a lot of people to join us. I know every Mass here got their own choir, so we basically try to build up something here on the 5:30 Mass on Sundays.
Our Lady of Guadalupe has a polyglot congregation, and the church's mandate is to include all cultures in the liturgy. So on a typical Sunday, the Mass takes us around the world a bit, from the Philippines all the way to sunny Mexico. A Spanish-language Mass is accented by a guitar-rich Mexican choir.
We have an organized way to worship, but it can be enculturated. And so each group brings its gifts, its culture, its outlook to the worship experience, and that gets amalgamated. It says to the people, well, there's something wider than just here. This extends the borders, you know. What happens at Our Lady of Guadalupe is also maybe happening in Samoa. It's almost happening in Mexico, maybe happening in Latin America, and we're part of the broader picture.
And that broader picture includes the unmistakable rhythm of the South Pacific. At St. Benedict's Church down the street, a Samoan choir keeps ancient Samoan traditions alive in the North Pacific. The sound of the wooden pake taps out percussion, while around 60 Samoan men and women dressed in white and island necklaces harmonize in their own language. And so the music, in whatever form, whatever language, conveys the message of faith.
Lord Jesus Christ, to send your apostles and leave you peace, my peace in you.
And brings the familiar melodies of home to folks who have put down roots in frozen Alaska. And that's AK for this week. We had help from John Ryan in Juneau and the guys at Crab Bait Radio in Petersburg. Our theme music is by Bumua. Our 300 Villages theme is by Tranquilla. For more on the other music we use, head to our website, akradio.org. AK's Scott Burton reported from Juneau this week, and our former host, Rebecca Shear, contributed from Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Gooseberry Peter. Our producer is Jessica Cochran. And our editor and executive producer is Duncan Moon. I'm Ellen Lockyer. Join us next week for another in our series of statehood specials.
Thanks for listening to the podcast version of AK. To listen to the broadcast version or to hear earlier shows from our archives, visit akradio.org. Send feedback about the show to ak@aprn.org. And if you like what you hear, remember to support your local public radio station.